KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rally Against War in Iran and Venezuela on Sunday, July 28th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Salmon Street Fountain Plaza in Waterfront Park in Portland. This march and rally will primarily focus on the possibility of U.S. military intervention in Iran and Venezuela, but also calling attention to the use of sanctions as economic war. Again, that's the Rally Against War in Iran and Venezuela, and Sanctions Kill People Too, on Sunday, July 28th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Salmon Street Fountain Plaza in Waterfront Park, downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radiance of Resistance, a night with Jana Jihad on Monday, July 29th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Jana Jihad Tamimi, 13-year-old Palestinian activist, began recording, reporting on, and sharing her lived reality from the age of 7, shortly after two of her relatives were killed by Israeli forces. Jana now enjoys a global following, serves as ambassador of the South African Palestinian Children's Initiative, and has been awarded internationally for her media role. Again, that's Radiance of Resistance, a night with Jana Jihad on Monday, July 29th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1226 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 11:01 a.m., and that means it's time this week for the Radio Zine. And we're featuring an encore presentation of last November's segment on mutual aid disaster relief, reminding us that a state's priority is always its own supremacy, never the needs of the people. So, let's have a listen. This is your community radio, KBOO Portland.
So this is just our second tour, and like Peyton said, we've just been around since 2016. So in the spring we did an East Coast tour and got to visit some really rad communities there. And then this is our fall tour on the West Coast. And our network is mostly based right now on the East Coast and in the Gulf, and we have a lot of experience mostly responding to hurricanes and floods, so we've been learning a lot about some of the things y'all have been learning about, responding to fires and droughts and some of the other disasters that are unique to this area, and then also some of the similarities, like the right-wing militia groups that have been responding to disasters, which we'll talk a little bit about later. And I think we've kind of boiled it down after this like month and a half on the road so far of really just wanting to share this like spirit of mutualism that we want to engage with when we enter disasters and respond to them. That is the acute disasters that the network is kind of more experienced in. And then we also want to learn from these acute disaster responses and see what we can like stretch out of that, all that momentum and energy that gets put into responding to those acute disasters. I really love to share this story about a family that the group that I'm part of that formed in response to Harvey got to meet. The group I'm part of is called West Street Recovery, and we're still going. And we were up in the neighborhood.
Some brief technical mess here, and we're going to straighten that out just as soon as possible. Stay tuned. Thank you.
their driveway as a distribution center. So they were collecting the excess of that their neighbors had of supplies and whatever else they could get their hands on, and then redistributing it out to their neighbors and distributing info to their neighbors. And so we started interfacing with them and trying to figure out what they needed and how we could support them the best. And so they'd say, oh, we need, three mattresses, or we need some fans. And so we'd get that to them, and they could continue being the face of their recovery effort up there. So as we got to know this family, we learned that Petra and Raul and their two adult children and two grandchildren were all living in tents in their driveway. And it was getting colder and colder, and FEMA and the aid institutions were giving them the runaround in the application process for financial support to rebuild their home. And as it was getting colder, they were saying, we just need one room in our house that's insulated and had drywall in it so that we can be secure and start moving forward on our recovery. So with that in mind, West Street Recovery didn't have any, well, we didn't have much construction experience. Raul did, but he also had some health issues. And so we got the supplies because we had some financial resources, and he taught us how to drywall one of his rooms. And then we kind of kept going on his house, but we were also in communication with all these other families that also were in really similar situations. They weren't getting help, it was cold, they had health issues, that sort of thing. And so Raul, like long before Petra and Raul's house was finished, like anywhere close to finished, Raul would join us on our cruise and help us like put parts of people's homes back together, like just like in this effort to kind of get people unstuck and like move forward in their recovery, like on a like case by case basis. And he was really influential in like supporting us with his expertise. And then Petra, meanwhile, would cook these like bomb ass Mexican food meals and invite everybody over. So even when we weren't working on their house, like 20 of us volunteers would like all go over to their house and we'd share food together. And that was just like a really special relationship that we formed. Fast forward, it's over a year after Harvey hit last August, and Raul is still working with us. We finally got him to accept some money for some of the jobs that he's doing. We just got a grant, and he's one of four people on kind of like this main team that's continuing to do these rebuild projects, which is just like really cool to like have him engaged through this process. This family was just like really influential in our understanding of like what mutual aid looked like, because Petra and Raul were already working in mutual aid for their community and neighborhood when we met them. And our role very much got to be just supporting them in their immediate needs with the resources that we could get our hands on, so that they could do that on a broader scale. And another thing that we got to do for them, we feel like, is provide some of the vocabulary so that they could continue to be like more effective advocates of these concepts. And now Raul these days talks in terms of like mutual aid and solidarity, and yeah, it's just really special relationship that got formed and story that I like to tell.
I want to share a story from Michigan. I'll talk a lot about Michigan. I love my state, or at least I love the people that happen to inhabit the place that is so-called Michigan. These three creatures up here are doing something that I think is really amazing. They're using their bodies to perform direct action. They're stopping this large development or this terror from coming into their community, and that's something that my comrades and I have been doing a lot of, or at least we've been encouraging people to do the same. I'm curious if, with a quick show of hands, there's anyone in the room who has not heard the name Richard Spencer. That's amazing. It's amazing that everyone happens to have the unfortunate. There is. Where? Someone. It doesn't matter. Thank you for raising your hand, whoever you were. Richard Spencer is a person who believes that, very much like David Duke from the Ku Klux Klan, that the suit and tie approach to white supremacy is the more successful one, that people who are able to find themselves in positions of power and legitimize white supremacy can create what he believes and calls an ethno-state, or a state in which only white people reside while all of the rest of us are kicked out. And we can understand exactly what those tactics would be. We've seen this in history before, and so anti-fascist, anti-racist action is an antithesis to this. People are mobilizing against not just people like Richard Spencer, but these institutional forms as well. Like I said earlier, I organized with a group called Solidarity and Defense out of Michigan. We got word that Richard Spencer was going to be coming to our state. He was going on a college speaking tour, He was notorious, along with a bunch of other people, for going to the University of Richmond in Virginia last year, which is in Charlottesville. There was one person who was murdered by a white supremacist there after a lot of counter-demonstrations. Her name was Heather Hare, and we're memorializing her still to this day. And after this happened, there was a lot of energy. When we heard that he was going to be coming to our state, we had about 4 months of time to prepare. So we started reaching out to our community. We started remembering things that had been somewhat lost in our greater movement. I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and this image is inspired by a shot that was taken in 1998. This was the last time that white supremacists were able to march in the streets of Ann Arbor. This image was captured and turned into a silhouette. It's now referred to as the Goodnight White Pride image, but it was a black man who took direct action to kick this Nazi in the head and kick him out of our community, and that successfully worked and repelled them, at least in the obscene sense, right? We understand that the liberals who are in power in Ann Arbor are still capable of white supremacy and practice this thing. And so what we did, instead of trying to create this like large mobilization to just fight the Nazis, we wanted to get out popular power. So we reached out into all of our relations in the greater Midwest. We created a set of principles. We were remembering these images and holding them, and we were creating and integrating a larger narrative of anti-racist, anti-fascist, and anti-colonial action. So at the same time that we were preparing for this, the Larry Nassar scandal was unfortunately happening as well at the Michigan State University, which is where Richard Spencer was going to be speaking. We were able to integrate that into our anti-patriarchal approach as well, into our narrative, and the Flint water crisis was still happening, so we were able to integrate that into our narrative as well. This was not just Richard Spencer, but it was a multifaceted, intersectional approach that we were able to create, and that was leading us to call what we had that day of resistance a festival of resistance. We had clowns, we had people with brass bands, we had clergy, we had students, we had teachers, we had parents of students. We had people who were black blocked up. I'm a former J20 defendant, and so I have no heavy critiques of the black block tactic. I think that it has a time and a place. And I think that with an intersectional approach, when we had a diversity of tactics, when we had mutual aid in our coalition building, we had a successful day where we were able to stop the Nazis from getting in and having their talk the next day. Richard Spencer, after getting literally ran out of the state of Michigan, said that the college speaking tour wasn't any fun anymore and that he was going to cancel it. I don't say this to pride, solidarity, and defense. It wasn't just us out there that day. It was us working with a bunch of other people, but it's because of the coalition building that we were doing across the state of Michigan, because of the work that we were doing in tandem with all of our comrades and all of the people who were activated by this moment, common people coming out and showing up, the diversity and the celebration of that thing that really stopped this disaster from coming into our community, and we're still building on those relations to this day.
My story of mutual aid is purposefully very different than those of my comrades to make a few points about mutual aid to y'all. And as I said before, I'm from Menominee Land, southeastern Wisconsin. I'm also from the most conservative county in Wisconsin. And that means semi-rural, white, middle, upper middle class folks. And one thing that we get a decent amount of in southeastern Wisconsin is snowstorms. And I grew up with my full-on privilege blinders on and had no sense of mutual aid. Our neighbors were people that we knew their names, but you said hi to them and you didn't really do anything else. There were no networks of meeting each other's needs. And one day when I was a teenager, a really bad snowstorm hit, and I remember driving my brother's friends home and coming across this car that was stuck on a pretty sketchy precipice with people in it who couldn't, it was so icy they couldn't even walk. And this instigated a 3-4 hour process of calling neighbors, people down the street, figuring out who had salt, who was okay with having their car parked, where, who could stay at whose house, who had food to feed who. And it was intellectually cool, but I remember having this sensory experience of like, oh, this feels so nice and natural, like it's what we automatically did. So one of the points that we're going to make to you today a lot is that mutual aid is our default behavior, that it's what we go to, and it's our humanity, and it's natural, and that that gives us a lot of hope going forward, given the state of things now. And also, that as long as we're in these systems of oppression and we've internalized them, mutual aid comes out in a discriminatory fashion. It's stratified. So it was just among like middle and upper middle class white people. It isn't automatically across all of our default lines, across all of our fault lines of systems of oppression. So we have to really do the work of dismantling those within ourselves in order for mutual aid to flow freely as it would naturally. And building on that, we have these beautiful webs of connection showing what these mutual aid networks look like when we're free of systems of oppression, when we act in this way towards each other by default. And our argument is that mutual aid isn't just here in us now, it came first. It came before colonialism, it came before capitalism. And these systems have purposefully and continue to purposefully try to bury this instinct in us. Because if we have this, then we don't need them. And what we have today is, is disaster capitalism, which is a particularly nasty combination of neoliberalism and climate and eco-social chaos. And it's where systems of power, represented by the folks around the table, deliberately profit off of disasters, many that they made, but they didn't even know that they could, that they would make. And then they made them and they're like, ooh, this is useful for profiting. And now we're getting to the point where they're seeing how profitable these disasters are, so they're making even more on purpose for even more profit. So I'm sure lots of you have heard of Naomi Klein and the Shock Doctrine. That's one of the... Do we have that book back there today?
I think we're sold out.
I think we sold out. Never mind. We normally have the book in the back. She talks about this approach of specifically creating economic disasters so that policies can be pushed through to make it much more, much easier for corporations to profit off of our needs. And we know that this is happening, and we're going to get into the tactics of disaster capitalism today. And the reason that we do this, a lot of you already know some of these, but we do this so that we can prepare better. Because if we really know what's coming and can see from other disasters, then we can prepare better and we can respond better. And we can be more effective in our decentralized grassroots relief efforts and our ongoing organizing and how those work together. And so before we get into that heaviness, one last reminder that mutual aid is our instincts. It's just there. It's right under the surface. And we like to think about disasters as beautiful opportunities because they rupture and fracture these entrenched status quos. So not only is it a beautiful opportunity for us to create the world that we want and we deserve, but it's also so beautiful to see humans instinctually acting out of mutual aid in these disasters, even if they're not ideologically aligned with it or they don't know what on earth that phrase means. So keep that in you as we go through the heavy stuff.
Yeah. Okay, I get to start the heavy stuff. the first tactic of disaster capitalism that we want to address is the manipulation of people geographically. So y'all might be aware that the borders, both in Europe and in the United States, and in Canada, are becoming more and more militarized and more bulked up. It's a real focus of policy these days, this obsession with immigration. And we believe, we understand that to be because governments are very aware that climate chaos is on the horizon or is already affecting communities and is a driving force of migration. And so it's a very preemptive measure to block off and wall off property and resources and wealth and security within these defined borders and our countries and states. So as these communities, mostly like indigenous communities, are destroyed by these mega projects that neoliberalism spreads, and their water is polluted, and they go through droughts and can't grow their own food anymore, and become more and more dependent on these capitalistic structures. They're being driven out of their rural villages and communities where they had these strong networks of mutual aid, and more into areas and lifestyles that depend on capitalism. And then when they have to flee their homeland, they're met by these militarized borders, and then the capitalists can then make profit off of them, again, by putting them in detention centers and prisons and so on. Another way that people are manipulated geographically in the face of disasters is by displacement. So we see a really good example of this in Puerto Rico after Maria, which we'll reference a lot tonight because it's a really good example of how disaster capitalism is using the shock of Hurricane Maria to opportunize on a colonized island that they had already been investing in as this like tax haven and getaway for the rich elite. So after Hurricane Maria, we saw 200,000 people leave Puerto Rico for the mainland. And a lot of them received federal funding to do so. But they're not going to receive any funding to return back to their homeland because that's not where we want, that's not where the US government wants them. Quite the contrary, there are many business investors that are eyeing Puerto Rico. There's even cryptocurrency bros that are trying to buy up enough land so that they can start a whole city that runs completely off of cryptocurrency. It's really nasty stuff. And just to bring it a little bit further or closer to home, in Lake County, California, in Northern California here, we saw 3 fires hit in the last 3 years there, and really devastating and burned down a lot of homes. And a lot of people were displaced in that. And the one of the board of supervisors was interviewed at one point recently about how, wasn't he concerned that the only people who are getting aid were the people who already had property and houses that were destroyed in the fire? And, like, what about the other people who don't have those resources to return? And his response was, we don't want them here anyway. Like, they're lazy and they don't want to have jobs. Like, if they don't have money, then we don't want them here. So we see this, like, very blatant addressing of this desire to displace people so that they can continue to gentrify and profit and improve the economy, since the economy is the thing that their main objective that they're working towards. And so through these acts of displacement, through these recoveries from disasters, we see this disenfranchisement. So in Puerto Rico, there's so many like town hall meetings and different decisions that need to be made about how the recovery is going to look for them, and the same in Lake County as well. And there's people that are organizing in the states trying to find out, like, figure out how to Skype into these town hall meetings so that they can participate in the recovery process and the decisions around that, because there are so many decisions to make in a recovery. And so it's this form of disenfranchisement to displace people and then not allow them to, or not provide resources for them to come back to their land, and actually make it harder for them to come back to where they were from before a disaster.
On that note of displacement, we can go back to Michigan as well, thinking about the Flint water crisis. I mentioned earlier Governor Rick Snyder. He ran on his campaign originally as one tough nerd, that he was going to run Michigan's government like a business, and he's been doing that very well, and that's not a good thing. One of his friends is the Nestle Corporation, depicted here in this image, titled The Maine Drain. It's about water extraction in Maine, but we understand that Nestle is extracting water all over the world, along with Coca-Cola and a number of other extractors. In Michigan, Governor Rick Snyder, the very same week that he signed another issue, said that Nestle would be able to draw about 3 times as much water as it already had been from Michigan aquifers for just pennies on the dollar. That other issue that he signed that week was that the Nestle water bottles that were being supplied to Flint residents for after the 4 years of the Flint water crisis and scandal would be discontinued. That the water that people were using for their cleaning and their cooking, for taking care of their children, for bathing, would be taken away, and all of this would then be given, this bounty, to the same corporation. Thinking about the Flint water crisis as an ongoing disaster, which it is, we have to understand exactly what led to it. Thinking about the idea of displacement, these ideas of the neoliberalism that my comrades have spoken about so acutely already, we can break it down into a few parts. There's this tactic of neoliberalism called predatory lending. It's used on small nation states and municipalities. Detroit was a playground for this. There's this idea that if a state government can lend money to a municipality or a country to another smaller sub-country, then that country is now in debt. And if they can't pay back that debt, then they're given these systems of restraints that put them into economic subservience. Detroit was bankrupted. Flint was bankrupted. These things happen intentionally. This money is a system of control and power, as I hope most of us in this room know. And so after Flint was bankrupted, this allowed an emergency manager to come in. This was not a person who was voted in, but a person who was appointed to then take over the city because of this state of emergency. That person knowledgeably took water from the pollution of the Flint water, of the Flint River, and flew that into the municipal water mains that were already corroded. They were about 100 years old and made of lead. So the water crisis was already sort of brewing, as it has been in many cities across the country. Flint is not unique, unfortunately. There's native territories that have nuclear contaminants in their water. And so I don't say this saying that Flint is unique, but this is a great example. After this water was knowledgeably taken and the pipes that were already corroded were made worse, if people chose then to not pay for the poison that was coming through their drains, their water was cut off. If their water was cut off, they were then open to eviction. If they were evicted, then they ran the risk of having their children taken away if they were a family by Child Protective Services, leading to displacement, imprisonment, destitution, et cetera, et cetera. So these systems become formalized. Another tactic of neoliberalism is the legalization. We'll talk about the 14th Amendment in just a moment. But these systems that continually perpetuate these systems of people being pushed out intentionally, we see this in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, which we'll talk about in just a moment as well. But we have to understand this, as I'm sure people here in Portland know with housing rights, that it's essential for us to defend and to understand these territories so that when the disasters hit, we know what we're going to be looking out for when they're coming in and how we have laid the groundwork for ourselves to maintain our homes.
So in the same line of privatization, we also want to touch briefly on how the privatization of resources and public services is affecting people during disasters. So we saw these massive austerity measures in the last 10 years or so in Puerto Rico. And when Hurricane Maria hit, it really left a lot of people in a much worse situation. For instance, 98% of the energy in Puerto Rico is fossil fuel based, and all of it is shipped in from the mainland to Puerto Rico. So when that energy grid went down for months and months, people were living without electricity. And similarly with the food systems in Puerto Rico, there's a lot of monocropping going on, and this has been fueled by the Department of Agriculture's advice and support. And so the people who had these more traditional and varied farming practices got along a lot better after the hurricane. And there's this movement now in Puerto Rico that Naomi Klein also speaks about. You can read a little bit more about this movement for food and energy sources being transferred to more democratic systems and managed differently. Because when they privatize these public services, they take away our control and our input. So if we want to switch to more green energy alternatives, companies that privately own these resources aren't going to help support that as much when they're tied to the fossil fuel industries. Similarly, with education systems, we see this privatization of education systems following disasters. This happened to a very severe extent in New Orleans after Katrina in 2005. So many teachers were laid off after Katrina, and so many schools were closed and were replaced by charter schools, which are more profitable. One cool story about a school in New Orleans was that a community in a historically black neighborhood was facing the closure of this really important school to them, this Martin Luther King School, and it had been gated off. And with the cops watching, the community members cut through the locks and broke in and cleaned up the school, and that school is now the only public school in that area today. And we say this because it is helpful to be preemptively understanding these tactics of disaster capitalism, as in Puerto Rico, people were aware that the companies would try and come in and privatize their education systems, and so we're prepared more to defend against that.
And the final point that we want to make about privatization as a tactic of disaster capitalism is that it's not just the corporations who have the legal impetus to act for profit as their main objective, and it's not just governments sometimes acting on their behalf. It's also this third sector, the nonprofit NGOs, who are going to act in their own interest. And this is where we get back to the point of we really are the only ones who are going to save us. And there's another story that comes out of Katrina about this one, which is about a hospital called Charity Hospital, which is run by, was, kind of still is, run by Louisiana State University, a public institution, which isn't legally required to act to maximize profit. And Charity Hospital is in a poor black neighborhood. It mainly served patients who were not privately insured, and it's really important. It was the only hospital in the center of the city that had like a good functioning psych ward. It was really, really vital. And it was minimally damaged by Katrina, actually. And the minimal damage that there was, volunteers came in to try and fix it up. And a few weeks after Katrina, it was declared usable. It was declared good to go. But it was never reopened in the wake of Katrina. And now it's a shadow of its former self with very few services. And the reason why it was never reopened was because Louisiana State had plans to build a schnazzy new state-of-the-art complex in a different part of the city with a different patient demographic where most of the patients would be privately insured. And they wanted the FEMA compensation money, which they would only get if they could prove that at least 50% of the building had been damaged. So they directly sabotaged their own building and prevented volunteers from helping with the cleanup and repair, so that they could get enough money from FEMA to kickstart their building of a new complex in a different part of the city. And so this is just a reminder that it's also the nonprofits who are supposed to be serving us that aren't going to serve us. And we just like to point out here that Mutual Aid Disaster Relief is also registered as a nonprofit. But the important difference is that we are a decentralized network, and the only reason we have any legal status is to keep like our donations and stuff in order. We're not trying to keep ourselves going as an organization. We're not existing to fix a particular problem that we're trying to keep in existence. Privatization, the way you didn't expect it.
You've been listening to the voices of three members of Mutual Aid Disaster Relief who spoke on October 26th at Portland State University as part of a national tour to organize the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief Network. This movement began in New Orleans in 2005 following Hurricane Katrina with Common Ground Relief. It has now spread like a rhizome across the country, wherever people are coming together in solidarity and community to deal with emergencies and disasters themselves. You can find more information at mutualaiddisasterrelief.org.
As a final point for neoliberalism and some of the tactics that it uses, we want to talk about militarization. That oftentimes when these disasters happen, a lot of guns come into communities. Not all the time, but it is something we should be aware of. Not only the formal military, but also private military contractors. We can think of Wackenhut, Blackwater, Tiger Swan. Some of these people are also seen defending pipelines like the Keystone XL pipeline in North Dakota. Oftentimes, before FEMA, before the Red Cross, it's ICE or the military that people are confronted with first. These people who are seeking to hunt other human beings for the sake of supremacy. In Florida, after Hurricane Irma, there was a sheriff who came out and said in Polk County that if anyone wanted to find a shelter in Polk County with an active warrant or questionable documentation status, that they would find shelter in the Polk County Jail. In Hurricane Florence in North Carolina, in Wilmington, which we'll talk about soon, it was ICE that was seen out in Border Patrol and Customs that were seen before people were receiving aid from the Red Cross. So it just shows the, as I hope once again we'll continually say this, everyone in this room is aware of that the state's priorities are for its own supremacy, not for the aid of human beings. Then that's something we need to be very, very aware of and continually integrate into our analysis. So something that we've learned on the flip side of that, to add a little bit of light to this very dark conversation that we're having currently, is that there are a number of people in Polk County in this instance, and here in the Pacific Northwest, down in Northern California with the fires, people reaching out to mosques or to other places of worship and asking ahead of time, are you going to interact with the police? Are you collaborating with ICE? Is this a truly safe place for people to go? And if so, how do we collaborate and do that in a way that can actually give people autonomy and control over their lives, not just put them into an institution? We'll talk a lot about that tomorrow for people who want to come out to the workshop. It's a lot more participatory, and we get to explore some of these options and tactics that we can use to protect the people in our community. I know that Portland is supposed to be a sanctuary city. I say supposed to be because I understand that the community here is in tight contention with its local government. And so that's a part of the conversation we can have as well, thinking very strategically about how we defend against militarization in the wake of disasters. We can think about how colonization continues through these new formal tactics that neoliberalism uses. If you're not familiar with the triangle trade so much or the tactics of early colonization, I know a lot of people today identify as anti-colonial or decolonial. We can see anti-colonial struggles as being something that is anti a thing. But what does it mean to be decolonial, right? It means to compost these systems truly. It's not enough just to be against these things. It's not enough just to have this idea that these things are bad. India had an anti-colonial struggle and in and of itself became a nation state. And still continues to subject people to these different oppressions and dominations. So in a decolonial struggle, we have to understand these different tactics. We like to think that colonization has five parts. Invasion. After the land is conquered, then there's the taking. There's the taking of human bodies, there's the taking of the resources, there's the taking of the culture, the hearts and the minds, right? Then there's the making. The construction of raw goods and materials that can then be, for the fourth part, exported, brought back to the metropole, brought back to the colony hub, and then there's the return, the expansion of this thing. It continues in this very cyclical way. And so the triangle trade is a really great example of that. Going from this ship in the bottom right-hand corner, we can see King Kool-Aid, who's steering this sugar ship. It's got molasses and rum from the Caribbean that it's then exporting back to the different colonial hubs in Europe to be exchanged for gold and for guns, to then come back to Africa and to the rest of the diaspora and collect more bodies, to then continue this cycle over and over again. This is why we have the 13th Amendment, the amendment with the gigantic loophole saying that slavery was illegal, except for, of course, those who were incarcerated. That's why it became illegal to be a black person in this country effectively, or to be native, or to effectively not be white. I have to shout out all my relations in this. This is a multifaceted struggle. The 14th Amendment is one that people not necessarily have as much connection to, but is very, very important. It comes out of the rhetoric of the 13th with that gigantic loophole. So when the human beings were given their sovereignty, right, in this nation state and became citizens, they were once seen as property. Another form of property was the corporation. And so the corporation then, with the slide of the tongue, with this sort of like twisting of the words, then also became a human being underneath the 14th Amendment. And that's why we can understand that these corporations have so much power, because they have the same amount of power that we as human citizens in this country, those of us who have been granted with that privilege, have economic, religious, political, and social freedoms that these corporations are exercising too. So nowadays it's quite legal for a corporation to, if a city of a group of people are resisting, let's say like the development of a mine or the erection of a dam or the clear cutting of a forest, to sue that municipality or to sue these individuals because of their First Amendment and 14th Amendment and even their Fifth Amendment rights. And so that's something that we really need to think about moving forward as well, is the legalese that these people are using to try to justify themselves. Clearly, I didn't consent to these laws. I didn't participate in making them. They weren't written for my ancestors, and hopefully not most of yours. But we can understand that through deciphering the coded language that they use, we can become much more intelligent in the way that we create these tactics of struggle against them.
We like to give y'all a little bit of a timeline to give you a sense of kind of where we're coming from and what experience this network has been pulling from, some of the lessons that we've learned, which we talk a lot more about tomorrow in depth. We start off by saying that is getting worse. In case y'all hadn't heard, it's really scary. IPCC just released a report that we have about 12 years to figure the out. It's true, the disasters are ramping up in frequency and in magnitude. The fires in Oregon are burning so hot, they burn the seeds that are, you know, use the fire to germinate. Like, it's, the hurricanes are really strong. Things are looking grim. So we need to prepare ourselves. We need to prepare ourselves tactically, emotionally, psychologically, collectively. And we really hope that by building this network that we can start building these bridges across the country so that we're not learning lessons twice or however many times making our work efficient and making sure that we're really like composting this old world that doesn't work for us so that we can build something new and much better. That's the goal. So we start our story with Common Ground, which was a collective that formed in 2005 after Katrina hit New Orleans. And it was created mostly by a former Black Panther named Malik Rahim. And Common Ground did a lot. They had dozens of different types of survival programs that they were doing. And they were very inspired by the Black Panthers' use of survival programs. People think that the Black Panthers were a threat to the state because of their guns, but it was really the survival programs that they had curated and these systems of mutual aid and the ways that they were able to support themselves and protect themselves that made them a real threat. So in Common Ground, we see this continuation of this use of survival programs. Common Ground did so many different types of programs, they kind of got lost in it. They had millions of dollars flowing in. They had tens of thousands of volunteers coming in, mostly like white college students on their spring break trying to help out. And their effect on New Orleans, it was an interesting one. It's one that we draw a lot of lessons from. Some of the people in our network helped participate in the Common Ground Collective. And experienced a lot of different issues there. With so much money and so many people and so many different programs going on, this attempt at making a decentralized horizontal collective didn't really work. It just, when things expand that fast and you're doing so much, it's really hard to maintain group buy-in and decision-making processes and to, you know, make sure that you're protecting yourself against the patriarchy and the racism that we're trying to uproot in our recovery efforts. But we learned a lot. A lot of people were from the anti-globalization movement and had previously learned how to cook like a huge amount of meals for hundreds of people, doing street medic work, doing independent media work. These are all skills that we're building and using when disasters hit. And we saw them all in full effect in the Common Ground Collective.
Moving on, we can think about in 2010, the earthquake that rocked Haiti saw a lot of different responses. The state had its responses, the nonprofit industrial complex, we could call them responses or lack thereof. Clinton Foundation put, I think, like 8 buildings down in a place that wasn't even hit by the earthquake as heavily as other parts were. So we can see these different lapses. We have to be very candid also in saying that there were lapses in the way that people like us, people who are going to these really sexy 2-hour and 8-hour workshops on mutual aid and survival tactics through revolutionary fervors, also fall into these traps of, you know, missionary complex and the savior complex and disaster patriarchy as well. The first time that mutual aid disaster relief was used as a name was in response to this. There was a bunch of people who kind of came out of these movements of, like Leah said, the anti-globalization era, people who had a lot of skills, people who had affinity with each other, and they wanted to do what they could to help out this people in need. And so they went down, and they had very little connection. They had a really hard time finding their way, not just through the language, but also through the culture too. The state has a different tactic, the institutions have different tactics, and the people themselves hold each other in a completely different way than these activists were ready and prepared to handle. And so that mission wasn't necessarily a success in the way that they thought it was going to be, but it gave us a lot of insight into how this current iteration of Mutual Aid Disaster Relief operates. We don't send people out of country. We don't send people anywhere. We're a bunch of people who are all working together and uplifting each other's struggles. We're not an organization that administers aid. We're one that is us. Everyone in this room, everyone who we're connected with, is doing the damn thing. We are Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, and that's a very powerful thing to think about. It's also a very daunting thing to think about, because who the hell are we, right? We have to identify who we are to each other and with ourselves, and that's building trust. And so that's a lot of why we're doing this right now, is to not make those same mistakes. Because, like my comrade said earlier, it's calorically inefficient to continually reinvent the wheel. Before I leave Haiti, I really want to point out that the flag of the Haitian people was adapted from the French flag, the colonizers of this island who were literally kicked out. Once again, I like talking about black people kicking white people out of places, at least those that are practicing these forms of supremacy. I have good comrades that happen to be white people. But they took, in the end of their revolution, the French flag, and they chopped out the white part, and they took the red and the blue and put it back together, and they claimed themselves as the Haitians. Unfortunately, Haiti is also very much like Puerto Rico, been subjected to colonial rule and austerity after this, and so this is something that these activists didn't necessarily come in with a full critique of when they were trying to help. Next, we can think about Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy. When we think of New York, we don't necessarily think of hurricanes. And so, like Leo was saying, this is really getting real. Places that we don't necessarily think of being hit by certain types of disasters, or the disasters that they're regularly hit with, are becoming worse. The frequency of these things and the magnitude of them is just becoming exponential. And so, when Superstorm Sandy hit, there were a bunch of people who were already coming out of the Occupy movement, and they called themselves Occupy Sandy. They took their skills after the Occupy movement had been crushed forcibly by the state and sort of dispersed, and they were able to think about using their bicycle power generators and building their collective tool sheds and working with each other in these systems of mutual aid, because they had the vision of building a new world that went beyond just this sort of stratified 1% model that they were so articulate in being able to point to. And so instead of once again doing the administration thing, they were actually going door to door to people and asking them, what is it that you need for yourself? What are you doing? And if they didn't speak the language, if it was Mandarin or Russian or Spanish, they would find someone who could interpret, come back, ask those same questions, and if it was insulin that they needed, well, we have some people who have that and we can bring that. We can get people connected in a real way and allow people to continue doing the damn thing and leading their own struggle in a really real way. And Occupy Sandy was largely successful because of that. There's a lot of resources that you can find. Unfortunately, I can't vibe with this for too long online. I believe that you can Google Occupy Sandy and find the resources, or you can go to mutualaiddisasterrelief.org. And we've got a lot of links to a lot of our comrades, and Occupy Sandy is one of them. A lot of the people who came out of that movement are still operating with the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief Network, within the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief Network today. We can think then also about the Baton Rouge floods that hit Louisiana in 2016. These floods were met by a group of people who came from the community this time, and they self-identified as Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. This was the second time that people used this tactic and this name in a really real way. They were leading their own recovery. In this image here, we can see all of these different types of people coming from different backgrounds, wearing different shirts, different signifiers, using their diversity of tactics, using their different community resources to pool these things together and build popular power in the movement, in the relief of this large disaster that hit their community. They were doing this so successfully that when Standing Rock began and water protectors were going to fight the state and to protect their land, they were able to send up from Louisiana a bunch of extra gas masks and respirators for people who were fighting in this struggle as well. So we can see the interrelation of these different parts. And that's a lot of how we're trying to move with this network today. Not just taking care of ourselves and our homes, but being able to push and pull each other in the direction towards collective liberation.
Yeah, so up next we want to talk about the hurricanes that hit in 2017. 2017 was a big year for disasters. We saw six major disasters in this country in the span of 3 months, including the major fires that hit over here on the West Coast, which we've been learning about. But we're going to talk about the hurricanes because that's where we've been interacting and experiencing. The first that hit was Harvey in Houston at the end of August. And it was super destructive. We saw response by the aid organizations and the military and doing rescues, but they were in predominantly white and middle and upper middle class neighborhoods, and that continued throughout the recovery period of those neighborhoods and those classes receiving the support, whereas the predominantly black and brown and lower income and historically marginalized neighborhoods were left to fend for themselves, which they did. There's like so many people took their boats out of their garages and went and did rescues, and that was really inspiring to see people activated in that way because they had to be. And it took a long time before we saw Red Cross and Salvation Army doing giving out meals in these neighborhoods that were food deserts and where the only superstore was closed up for weeks on end. So West Street Recovery, the organization that I'm part of, we were starting to mobilize, and Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, the network, reached out to us a couple days after the flood. They had just been looking out for autonomous groups that were reacting on a grassroots level and found us through Facebook or GoFundMe or something like that, and reached out to us to ask how they could support us. And so they ended up sending us an Amazon wish list of supplies that they plugged through their network. So we had tons of gear for mucking and gutting homes coming to our address before we were actually at that phase of things. And they were also this great resource for us to call and be like, you know, ask these questions of like, well, how long does it take to muck and get a home? And, you know, what do these phases look like and how long are they? And they were really supportive in that way, and also helped promote our page so that they could, you know, fundraise for us, which was really cool. And then next we saw in Florida, Hurricane Irma hit a couple days later. A lot of the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief members actually live in Tampa, and the hurricane was expected to hit really hard in Tampa, but it actually went a bit south and hit in particular a town called Immokalee, where there's a really amazing farm workers advocacy collective called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. And the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief folks had a good relationship with this coalition previously, and so when the hurricane hit, they were able to start redirecting supplies down from Tampa through down to Immokalee workers and let them continue to be the face of their recovery, like I was talking about earlier. In Irma, we also saw a lot of this, and we continue to see this as these hurricanes hit, this criminalizing of people who are trying to take care of their basic needs, and these right-wing militias that are responding with arms and patrolling for people, black and brown people, who are looting or providing for their needs in the wake of these disasters. And once again, we also saw ICE here very quickly after the hurricane hit. These police units and these right-wing militia groups are very much prepared and have the resources to react really quickly to these disasters, whereas it takes Red Cross and Salvation Army and FEMA a long time, sometimes weeks, to get down to these areas.
Autonomous direct action is this idea that, very much like we described in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, that it's the people power, the self-determination realized through action, that is the most effective thing that gets the goods. Even the state recognized this. In the wake of Hurricane Sandy, the Department of Homeland Security released a report saying that it was the autonomous grassroots power that outperformed the Red Cross and FEMA. They have since taken that report down, and I think that we can all assume why they would do such a thing. Dual power and sustainability. We've mentioned this again. I'm going to say a more organic way of finding our connections with each other, and that's the mycelial or the mycological connections that we can find with each other. Thinking about fungus, thinking about mushrooms. They allow, with their networks underground, the roots of trees to become connected with this really, really free market exchange of nutrients, information, and energy. And so if we draw from these mycological connections, and if we bring ourselves back into this organic state of being with the world around us and with each other, that in and of itself is a form of dual power. The two parts of that are composting and planting then the seeds of the world that we want to live in, inoculating, if you will, the world that we want to live in. What we really want is not just to come back to square one after a disaster hits and ravages our world, but we want to think more circularly than that. We want to really truly create these sort of revolutionary aspects within our movements that we say, and we'll say this a lot in our workshop tomorrow, community organizing is disaster preparedness, and disaster response is community organizing. We're not just doing this because we're just trying to get everything put back together, but we're actually thinking about when we see the aspects of the state falling apart, we have the opportunity to do exactly the work and the building that we want to do and we know we have the capacity to be able to perform. This image here I really enjoy. It's depicting the Highlander Center, which is a popular education center in Tennessee. People like Martin Luther King have passed through there and learned about how to become more effective organizers and facilitators. This image has an open chair, and I really enjoy that because it reminds us that there's always room for more people in these movements, in our social organizing and in these relief efforts, that we, if we become exclusive, are stopping the popular power of our capacity for our ultimate relief. In the top right corner, you'll see these songs and these books that are being stored and kept and remembered. This reminds us that if we're collecting these stories and if we're sharing these things freely with each other, we're building up our narrative, we're building up our collective memory, and we're reviving the spirit of our ancestors who fought before us and laid the groundwork and live within us to continue this work that's going on now. If we lose people to burnout, or if we lose people to other means, then we lose critical aspects of this movement. So we have to continually think about how it is that we take care of ourselves and each other. We'll talk about self-care as community care tomorrow and talk a lot more about the real diverse ways in which we can respond to burnout as well. And this final image here, it says revolution in our lifetime. And I think that's very poignant, that we're not going to knock on a door and be invited down the staircase and find all of these different comrades with Kalashnikovs who invite us into the revolution. And it's going to be this moment of awakening wherein we're invited to this thing. But that the revolution, as Gil Scott-Heron said, will not be televised, except, of course, it's being filmed right now, because everyone in this room is a part of the revolution, and what we're doing here, collectively dreaming and thinking together, and tomorrow as we're working popularly together to resolve some of our fears and our hopes, and building these collective visions, that in and of itself is a revolutionary tactic, and that in and of itself is a revolutionary practice that we can bring with us wherever we go. We like to think that what we're doing here in this space and time, like I said, from the Bardic tradition of sharing stories, is something like activist church. I see a lot of very heavy heads in here. I see a lot of nods. I see a lot of hearts that are pumping. I see a lot of very heavy minds in this room, thinking about all of these things that we're talking about, and thinking about how it is that we're going to respond to these very daunting tasks that we have before us. There's a quote that I think complements what Leah was just saying with this crack in the wall very well. It comes from the 1930s during the Spanish Civil War. There was an anarchist, anti-fascist, his name was Buenaventura Durruti, and he said something to the effect of, although our enemy might blast and ruin this world before they leave the stage of history, we are not in the least afraid of ruins because we hold in our hearts a new world, and that world is growing every minute, and everyone in this room is a part of that world. And we can think of that as being that kernel, like Leah was just saying, the uno, but the many yeses that are blossoming out of that thing. Before I leave you all to my comrades, I just want to say that to that note of the activist church that we're all in, we can sort of reclaim the sense of spirituality. I'm not going to get woo-woo on you right now. I just really want to share a story. Emma Goldman, who absolutely hated the notion of God, she hated the notion of state, she hated the notion of patriarchy and of masculinity through these systems of economic power and white supremacy, and she called them out by name and was sent to prison multiple times because of it. She was on tour speaking and went into rural Vermont and was asked by a small community of Masons. They were working and they all identified as anarchists. This was a community where people were literally naming their children Anarchos and Spartacus. There was a man who died there who had an unnamed grave. The only thing that was on it was the name Anarchism. And so she came into this community and she was asked by these people, would you baptize our children? And she looked at them like, what the hell? Like, who do you think I am? I'm Emma Goldman. Why would I do that? And they're like, no. Would you baptize our children in the name of anarchy? And she did. And so I think that in these spaces where we're able to see each other, and like my friend Cindy Milstein says, to practice rebellious mourning. We have a book in the back titled Rebellious Mourning. They're on a speaking tour right now talking about that book. When we cultivate these spaces of collective grieving, that in and of itself is a festival of resistance against these oppressive structures, and that in and of itself is a spiritual revolution too.
You've been listening to a recent talk given in Portland by the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief Organization. More information can be found on their website, mutualaiddisasterrelief.org. You can also find the full audio of this talk on our website, kboo.fm/radiozine.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Steve Earle and the Dukes with Lucas Nelson and the Promise of the Real. Sunday, August 11th, all ages welcome. Tickets and more information available online at zooconcerts.com.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil on Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990, Cuba's oil supply was cut by more than half. This film tells of the hardships and struggles, as well as the community and creativity of the Cuban people during this transition away from a highly mechanized agricultural system to one using organic methods of farming and local urban gardens. Again, that's How Cuba Survived Peak Oil, Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Another politician sitting far away. This is the battleground.
Hi, I'm Jeff Rosenberg. Tune in to the Song Circle every Friday afternoon at 1:30.